Hopefully it's the last time. We are in Matthew chapter 13 today. And we pick up with what sometimes are surprising circumstances. So I'd like to read for you a story today which may help understand, man, aren't there surprising circumstances in life? And so we have this. During the final stages of World War II in 1945, the United States dropped two atomic bombs on the Japanese cities of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. The first landed on August 6, 1945, and the second on August 9th. These two events are the only use of nuclear weapons in war to date. Within the first 2 to 4 months of the bombings, the acute effects killed 90 to 166,000 people in Hiroshima and 60 to 80,000 in Nagasaki. Tsutomu Yamaguchi was a Japanese national who survived both the Hiroshima and the Nagasaki atomic bombs. It should be noted that at least 160 people are noted to have been affected by both bombings, but Yamaguchi is the only person to have been officially recognized by the government of Japan as surviving both explosions. In 1945, he was a resident of Nagasaki, and he was in Hiroshima on business for the Mitsubishi Corporation. Mitsubishi produced the Zero Fighter, which was renowned in World War II, but now it's 30% owned by Ford and produces cars here in the U.S. History's a funny thing. Anyway, when the city was bombed at 8:15 on August 6th, Yamaguchi was 1.8 miles away from the center of the blast. Yamaguchi recalls seeing a bomber, two small parachutes, before there was a great flash in the sky, and I was blown over. The explosion ruptured his eardrums, blinded him temporarily, and left him with serious burns over the top half of his body. Yamaguchi did not receive treatment until he got back to Nagasaki the next day. Despite being heavily bandaged, Yamaguchi reported to work 3 days after the explosion. That day, at 11 a.m. on August 9th, he was involved in the second blast, which went off in Nagasaki. On that occasion, he was 1.8 miles away from the center of the blast. You think you've had a bad day. When the Japanese government officially recognized atomic bomb survivors, Yamaguchi was the only one identified as being present at both bombings. Interestingly enough, Yamaguchi recovered and died in 2009 at 93 years old. Wouldn't you have been just absolutely surprised that anybody could have had such a thing happen? And so we look at circumstances like that and we say, no, not possible, no way. And yet history stacks up and we find ourselves really shocked at what is true and real. And really, what we're doing here in the church is a part of that same thing. And so we approach today Matthew 13 and what oftentimes is a misunderstood passage, but Jesus is very forceful and clear in what is ultimately the message of the kingdom that he's preaching. And so we pick up in verse 31. He presented another parable to them, saying, "The kingdom of heaven is like a mustard seed, which a man took and sowed in his field. And this is smaller than any other seed, but it's when it's full grown, it is larger than the garden plants and becomes a tree, so that the birds of the air come and nest in its branches." And he spoke another parable to them, saying, "The kingdom of heaven is like leaven, which a woman took and she hid in 3 pecks of flour until it was all leavened." And all these things Jesus spoke to the crowd in parables, and he did not speak to them without a parable. And this was to fulfill what is spoken through the prophet, "I will open up my mouth in parables, I will utter things since the foundation of the world." And so we see these two parables oftentimes sort of slightly misunderstood. We look at them and we say, oh wow, look at this little seed that grows into this big thing. And isn't it amazing? Just a little bit of yeast, just a tiny bit, produces all of this risenness and bread. And we look at those two things, and oftentimes it is sort of preached and understood from the perspective of, look at this thing that God is turning into this huge thing. And I'd like to concentrate on a mustard plant for a second. Now, this isn't a particularly large tree. It's a decent-sized tree, but nothing out of the ordinary. It produces these little fruits, and these little fruits produce a spice that oftentimes is turned into mustard. And so we have our sort of crazy neon version of it in our refrigerators at home, that yellow mustard, which I absolutely love. And, you know, snobby people use the goldens or the spicy mustards, you know. And that's fine. We all have different grades. Water seeks its own level, and mine is that cruddy stuff that looks like it was born out of a chemical malfunction. But that's really its root, is that this mustard becomes this spice, and actually the leaves are eaten. In fact, camels love them. Camels love them, which I bet leads to interesting results. But more specifically, what Jesus seems to have in focus is this. The message of the kingdom is, you would never believe it. And so we see this in the Old Testament where God says, I am doing a thing that you know not of. I am doing a thing that you would never imagine. I am doing a new thing, says the Lord of hosts. And here in the New Testament, we see Jesus saying, look, there's a tiny little seed, so tiny that you would disregard it, so tiny that you would never guess what I have for it. And the interesting thing about a mustard fruit, you look at the beauty of God's creation and the way He makes things work. And when people draw the conclusion that there is no God, I just don't get it. But the fruit of the mustard tree actually has germination inhibitors in it. Because mustard, because it's so small and the way it's wired, it will bear fruit immediately. It will just start to sprout at the drop of a hat. And so God has so arranged that fruit that there is this inhibitor in it to keep that seed from jumping the gun. Isn't that amazing? And so that mustard seed, that tiny little piece of that fruit, that nothing of a seed, goes into the ground, and out of it comes a tree roughly the size of a good-sized dogwood tree. If you've ever seen a dogwood tree, I grew up with them, being from the South, being them, you know, the state flower and all that stuff, is that, well, this is that kind of tree. Not a particularly large tree, but you would never guess. And what Jesus is saying is, look, I'm doing a thing and you would never guess. You would never imagine. In the same way that if I told you about a guy named Yamaguchi who went through two atomic bombs exploding, the only two in warfare in all of history, and he stood there in the flash of both and survived to the age of 93, you'd say, I would never guess. Well, that's really the purpose here. Jesus is saying, look, I'm doing this thing. And in the same way, this woman, she takes this tiny little piece of starter. And we have to understand the way bread was made in the ancient Near East. Today, if you are any sort of baker, you tend to go and you buy a little packet of yeast in the store. And some of you have been through that process of starter breads where people have this little thing and it's this nasty, moldy, gross-looking lump that women pass around amongst themselves. And so it goes from person to person to person and proliferates and all that. But the idea, man, you put a tiny piece of activated yeast, this little organism of no significant notice or value, or you would just never guess, and it begins to reproduce and produce all of this gas and its gassiness. And it brings risenness to bread. It brings the taste of wonder to it. It's amazing. And Jesus is pointing both of these things as, I'm doing a thing that simply you would never guess at, imagine, envision, and implied is produced on your own. Jesus, indeed, never traveled more than 100 miles from his home. He never appeared to be anything less than a poor Jewish person living and preaching like many other pretenders to the throne of the first century. And as the apostles faced opposition from the Jews, Gamaliel and the council of the Sanhedrin said, "Gentlemen, we are faced with an issue, but we must learn from history. There have been many so-called messiahs and pretenders to the throne, and they have come and they have gone and they have ended in nothing." And so also with this sect of the Jews, these Christians, these believers, unless God is in it. And if we are against this thing and God is in it, not only are we against God, but our activity will be futile. And so incurred the kingdom, lived out in the hearts of men who have been dramatically changed. And we do. We look at the church, and we are so prone in looking at what is our daily activity and our ordinary circumstances, and whatever that is becomes normal and assumed. But if we could just step back and get out of ourselves and stop envisioning the world through what we're used to, look at what is done. The church began with simply Jesus, who looked like everybody else. And outside of miracles, preached a very similar message, which was oftentimes misunderstood and oftentimes intentionally, we have it here in this passage, intentionally obfuscated so that not everyone would understand. And so we would expect from that a certain loyalty base. We would expect from that a certain amount of success. We would expect of that a certain outcome, but we would not envision what it has become. Look at you. 2,000 years removed from the cross, and this room is filled up with people who it is just as relevant to today as it was in the first century. In the same way that those people were changed by the cross of Christ, there sits here today people who are recovering from alcoholism and drug abuse and divorce and affairs and addictions of all sorts and anger and fear. And you sit here today confident and changed and remarkably different from what you were by nature. Who would have ever guessed? And I was talking to a believer in this church, and they said, you know, years ago, I witnessed to these people. She said, you know, it's just, you know, the ordinary life of a believer where you mention the Lord and you live your life and you hope that they'll ask more questions and you hope for an open door. And she said, yeah, just sort of out there spreading that gospel. And I was at an event years later, and a man came up to me I did not recognize and said, "I bet you don't know who I am, do you?" He said, "I have no idea who you were and are." And he said, "I was the guy who dressed like this. My name's such and such." And see, "You're him?" "Yes." "Well, I hate to say it, but what in the world has happened?" And this was a guy who perhaps may have looked very familiar to some of us, but you know, he's sort of filthy and dirty overalls and sort of bummed around all the time, marginally unemployed and a drunkard. And here he was, a different man, dressed in decent clothes, obviously recovered and different, renouncing a life of sin. And he said, "I remember you talking about the Lord. And when I got to the bottom of things, I remembered and I went to church." and I got saved. You would have never guessed. That's the effect of the church. And Jesus says, look, guys, understand that I am beginning something that on the surface of it, in our experience of it, in the moment right now as I'm preaching, is a tiny thing, but you have no idea where this is going. Folks, you are where this is going. You sit here today as the recipients of God's gracious act in your life. Can you believe it? Do you get it? And I shudder to think of what I would be without Jesus today. Of the path that I was headed, of the end of my pride and self-sufficiency, of the end of my greed and desire for the things of the world, I shudder to think what I would be if it was not for the gospel. Jesus' death upon the cross. Don't you understand? And that crowd that heard and did not understand, you are not them. That should motivate you, Christian. You say, you know what? I've got to quit goofing around. I better be different than I am today. I should be. If Christ has begun a good work in me and has promised not to cease from it until I am complete in Him, presented before Him unstained as the church in all her glory, man, I better be about the business of God. That's the extension of the application of this passage. And so let's move on. Last week we discussed the tares, so this week we will look at verse 44 as he begins the issue of treasure and its basis. Notice two parables once again juxtaposed together, the first being the mustard seed and the leaven, the second being hidden treasure and a costly pearl. And we see the basis for treasure. The kingdom of heaven is like a treasure hidden in a field, which a man found and hid again. From joy over it, he goes and sells all that he has and buys that field. Well, very often, some of us will look at that and go, hey, is Jesus advocating this dishonest guy who finds something on another person's property and then hides it? So, please don't get hung up in the story. Please, be careful. Although there was a case of this. I think it was the largest intact asteroid found in the United States. Something on the order of thousands of pounds. A guy actually was out walking on another piece of property. It was, a timber company. And he found this enormous asteroid sitting out in the middle of the woods. It's a gigantic lump of iron, weighing thousands of pounds. It was early in the last century. And he said, hey, wow, this is really amazing. So he went home, contacted the company, said, hey, can I buy this property from you? They said, no, we're not interested. So then he systematically went through the process of hitching this thing up to horses and rolling it onto his property over a series of months using his kids. It's amazing what people will do when they get their mind to it. And then he was going to, you know, he was going to use it as a sideshow. And in fact, he did, until the lumber company went out and they did some investigating. There was a huge trough gouged into the ground from their property to his, and so he lost possession of his asteroid, his beloved lump of iron. But let's not get hung up in that. Jesus here is talking about the basis of treasure, and so we pick up the second one. Again, notice the transition. Like unto the first, the kingdom of heaven is like a merchant seeking fine pearls. And upon finding one pearl of great value, he went and sold all that he had and bought it. Notice here, in both instances, the seed of the story, the mustard seed of the story, if you will, is something of greater value than what I currently have. And this is the way we rate investment in our life. This is the way we look at, where am I going to go? What am I going to do? What is it I'm going to do? With my limited resources, what is my greatest investment? Notice here that it is predicated on the idea that my wealth and what I have is not without limit. Notice that. That most of us do not have the kind of money that means I can choose all things equally. That's really the predicate of any investment and any investment strategy. I don't have all that I want or need, so I have to make a decision here with what I have, what do I invest in? What really matters? And so these choices come up constantly. I don't have all of the time in the world, so where do I spend my time? And you have those choices. Do I invest more in work, or do I invest partially there and then spend or invest time with my kids? How much time with my kids is appropriate? How much time with my wife is appropriate? How much time at work is appropriate? How much time at leisure is appropriate? All of these things are based in the idea that I don't have unlimited resource. I was in an interview with my brother years ago for a paper I was writing, and my brother made a point, and it resounded with me, and it has stuck with me ever since. My brother is not a believer. He does not trust in the Lord. And he made this statement. He said, "I just don't understand how a loving and good God could hold us accountable and determine our eternity based in what happens in the quote-unquote relative eye blink of 70 years. Well, that's a good question. It's a question that I think probably resounds with the lost man. Is why would God hold me accountable for everything based on this life? It's actually the question that is brought up in Romans 9. And if you ever want an interesting study in sovereignty and God's working and willing in your life, look at Romans 9. But he asks this question, how can a good and loving God hold me accountable for all of eternity for the decisions that I make in this relative span of 70 years? And part of the answer, only part of the answer to that is, you have a limited resource. What are you going to invest it in? And actually, if you had unlimited resources, unlimited life, unlimited time, on this side of eternity, would you even bother with investing in God? Would you see the need? And actually, my answer to my brother is simply this. Based on the fact that we have 70 years, you need to make a decision. What really matters? I can tell you right now, maybe I'm the only sinner in the room, but if I was going to live forever, I wouldn't bother going to church. I certainly wouldn't bother hanging out with you people. It's probably not true. I really like you. You see the issue? If I had all of the time in the world, would I be doing this? Would I give God a second chance or even a glance? If I was sufficient within myself, would I ever invest in His things? This parable pushes the reality that in the limitations I have, what matters? Christian, based on the fact that you have a limited lifespan with only so much pleasure to take, only so many limits that you have, what should you be investing in? And the answer is, it better be something eternal if there's anything to this eternity business. It better be. If I'm sitting here preoccupied with the affairs of this life and the things of this world, knowing that they're going to go away, what in the world am I doing? What am I invested in? Something that's going to end. If somebody came to you with a stock tip and said, "Hey, Doran, I've got a stock tip for you. It's guaranteed to lose. And I know that the company's going to be out of business within our lifetime. What do you think?" You'd look at that person and you'd say, if I had all the money in the world, it might be fun to lose. probably not interested right now. Well, guess what? You are guaranteed to lose things in this life. Guaranteed. Many of you are on the front edge of life. Many of you young people, you're in the process of gaining an education and gaining a sharpness to your mind and gaining strength. I remember getting stronger. I remember that. And you're in the process of gaining family and friends and new relationships and giving birth to children and getting kids and all the trials and the good things that come with that. And life is going to be exciting. And guess what? You're going to lose every bit of it. At some point, you're going to lose your health. And if you have any doubt, just ask anybody older than you. All of their health is going away. They get sick and they die. Their bodies don't work like they used to. In fact, their bodies aren't shaped like they used to be. It's the way it is. You know? And I've got this thing up here that's somehow slowly migrating to where my belly is, and I know at some point my belt is going to be over my chest. It's going to happen. It's going to be happening. Right? That's happening to all of these people. And guess what? You're also going to lose your money. You're going to invest and get, and at some point, if you're very fortunate and God blesses, you're going to have resources saved up. And guess what those resources are for? Those resources are actually to finance your death. Congratulations. Your slow, withering death. And then when whatever's left, your kids are going to fight like dogs over. Sounds like family, doesn't it? Wonderful. And all of that stuff is going to go away. There's a point in life where life begins to remove from you everything that it gave to you on the front half. I'm actually in that stage now where I am slowly losing my parents, where I'm slowly losing my children who are getting older and don't need me like they used to. And I love, they just got interesting. And they're going to walk. And they aren't going to call me as much as I want to call them. They aren't going to see me as important. They'll call their mom. And that's what's happening. And if my sole investment is in the relationship of my kids and to my kids, and it's a relationship to my wife, it's a relationship to my money, well, all that's going to go away. And I've been working on a PhD, and Adam's been working on that doctorate, and you know, we're still at some point where we're going to gain that, but guess what? We're going to lose our wits. And we're not going to remember what we studied, what we wrote, or even care. What matters to you? Well, Jesus said, I deliver a seed. And what it's going to turn into, you would never guess. It's going to be glorious. It's going to be amazing. And you guys get to see it. How invested in that are you? Or is it just in the consumption of your day, the consumption of resources for the physical gratification of this life? Or are you investing in eternity? Can you spare just a modicum of time to read God's eternal, godly word? Or do magazines, television, and vapid conversation take up your whole day? Are you entreating one another? Or are you taking time to entreat the Lord of heaven, whom you have the ability to go boldly into the throne of grace? Is your fruitfulness measured in your retirement account? Or are you a bold and active witness for a kingdom that will be revealed, in which reward will be handed, in which God will say, well done or no? Or even, will you just wind up there and God says, you're in, but I have nothing to add to your investment portfolio because you didn't invest in my kingdom at all. I can't imagine anything more sad. And so again, Jesus gives another parable, beginning with the transition again. The kingdom of heaven is like a dragnet cast into the sea and gathering fish of every kind. When it was filled, they drew it up onto the beach and they sat down and gathered the good fish into containers, but the bad they throw away. So it will be at the end of the age. The angels will come forth and take out the wicked from among the righteous and will throw them into the furnace of fire in that place where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. Have you understood all these things? And they said, yes, we have. And Jesus said, therefore, every scribe who has become a disciple of the kingdom of heaven is like the head of a household who brings out of his treasure things new and old. That's actually the crux of that passage. And scribes were people really invested in the world. And Jesus said, but man, if one of them were to become a disciple, the things that they have in the Old Testament, the things that I've done in the past, well, they would gain new life out of them. They'd understand them from this perspective, from this eternal perspective, from this investment perspective. And these new things would gain a richness and a flavor hardly undreamed. I recently watched a show on fishing practices, and it was a documentary. And these poor people in the islands, and they were actually doing exactly this technique that Jesus is talking about, the dragnet fishing from the shore. And it was the whole village, and they dragged this enormous net out into the water. And as they went out up to their chest, and it was dozens and dozens of people hauling this weighty thing. And as they dragged it along, and then people started to sweep it in from the shore, and as they gathered it in, at the end of all of that work and the hours of exhausting work, there was nothing there but a handful of fish no more than 3 inches long. And a waste of it. And Jesus here is envisioning a different harvest. A harvest that comes in. And there are two kinds of fish in that. At the end of the age, it's meted out. There's an us and a them. Remember this from last week? Jesus here circles back around to it. And there's people in this who appear to be the real thing but are not. But the righteous, the ones who are God's people, the one who are wheat, who have a life of fruitfulness, well, they've invested. And on that day, the fruit of it's revealed. Where are you, Christian? What really matters? It should show up. It should show up in the way that you spend your time. It should show up in the way that you spend your thought life. It should show up in the relationships and in the way that you live out the fruit of the gospel. I want to tell you, not one of you should be upset with one another and mad at one another all the time. There should be a fruit of peace that reigns over every relationship. That's the gospel worked out in real life. It should show up in the way you spend your money. It should show up actually also in your giving. The way you give your time and your resources, the life that you have. Folks, what are you invested in? Have you found a pearl of great price in the church? Have you found a pearl of great price in this gospel worked out in the lives of people? Or is it just something in the back burner, on the list but not the list? That God's somewhere in the mix, but not your passion, your heart, the thing which frees you and the thing which contextualizes every other aspect of your life. Man, what do you care about? Invest. Put God at the top of the list, make Him the list, and then His things fall under it. All this other thing that the world's pursuing, it's dead-end investing. Don't waste what is limited on what will end in nothing. Let's go to prayer. Father, we do just thank You for Your work and willing in our lives. We just ask, Lord, that you would make us fruitful as we invest and seek a return, not in things which end in nothing, but things which end in what we would never have dreamed possible. You who are able to do beyond all that we think or imagine, to you be glory and honor forever. Amen.